are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie, and it is Pledge Week on KFAI. Tonight on Right On Radio, Dave Fettig talks with Jessica Lind Peterson about her essay collection, Sound Like Trapped Thunder. The Star Tribune says it's funny, weird, witty, and off-kilter in its delivery. Peterson's collection crackles with dangerous energy. Peterson is an essayist, playwright, arts administrator, and co-founder of Yellow Tree Theater in Osseo, Minnesota. Josh?
Thank you, Annie. And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, I'll be talking with Zevon Sipel, an award-winning journalist, on how Israel's actions run counter to the traditional historical values of Judaism and are putting Jewish people worldwide in an increasingly untenable position in the latest book, The State of Israel Versus the Jews. He lived in Israel for 12 years and is now based in Paris. His book, Walled, Israeli Society is at an Impasse, was published by Other Press in 2007. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Dave Fettig, and I am very pleased to introduce Jessica Lind Peterson to Right On Radio and KFAI. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
There you are. Yeah, way up there in Duluth, right?
Way up there in Duluth.
Yeah, we love Duluth. Thanks for joining us. Very excited to speak with you tonight. So, Jessica, we typically get started with a reading at the top of the hour to introduce our listeners to the voice of our writer. But before we do that, let's learn a little bit more about you. And how about telling us about your writing background? I know you're a playwright also. So why don't you give us a little background and Jessica Lind, writer.
Well, I started my writing career primarily as a playwright, mostly in the Twin Cities at a theater company I founded called Yellow Tree out in Osseo in the northwest suburbs. And I sort of fell into writing holiday comedies, which is never something that I saw myself doing. It sort of manifested more out of necessity than anything, because we always needed like a good small cast holiday comedy.
Yes, indeed.
So I started writing these sort of Minnesota-centric holiday comedies.
Okay, before you go on, Jessica.
They sold really well.
Yes, so give us a line. Give us one of the hee-haw great laughs you got from one of your holiday shows. Come on.
Okay, yeah. Now that you're putting me on the spot.
Yeah, of course I am. That's what we do here.
Well, I have six plays, and so they're all swirling in my head. you know, they're doing one coming up at it's called Miracle on Christmas Lake 2, the sequel.
Oh my gosh.
This winter. You have to just go see it.
Okay, you know what? We're all going to go see it. I used to live out by Christmas Lake, not on the lake, a much more humble home in the vicinity of Christmas Lake. But that's great.
Oh.
So that's a nice plug.
Well, I didn't know that there was a Christmas Lake when I started writing my Miracle on Christmas Lake series.
Oh,
and it was literally only 20 minutes away from where I was living. And I didn't know that, but
amazing.
So I started writing, I started writing plays, and I have some other romantic comedies. And then went to Hamlin a few years ago to get my MFA in creative writing and started exploring other genres. And I sort of fell into this form of the lyric essay, which I kind of fell in love with. And so then I started writing and publishing essays in literary journals and magazines. And I feel I'm a theater artist. And so this is a sort of a very dramatic kind of form. So it kind of fits me really well.
Nice. Well, thank you for that introduction. That's Jessica Lind Peterson. And now how about a reading from Sound Like Trapped Thunder, your collection, award-winning collection of essays, I might add. What are you going to read for us tonight?
I'm going to read from an essay called Dear GB. And what this is actually a letter to a grizzly bear. GB stands for grizzly bear. So
okay, nice.
Give me a little signal when my time is up, because I'm really bad with timing myself.
Okay, very good.
All right. Dear GB, you're here again, and this time you're sitting on the sofa with my mom. I can't stop staring at your claws. soft brown eyes like a middle school boyfriend, and a nose as big as a coffee mug, wet with snot, slick black lips. These details are almost too much, like a cartoon that I can smell. You pant hot, deep tuba breaths through your open mouth in perfect staccato rhythm. Have you swallowed a metronome? Are we at band practice? You're staring at me, staring at you from across the living room entryway, one hand on the doorknob in case I need to escape. No offense. The living room scene is appearing very dignified, and I fully expect finger sandwiches to be served on a wheelie cart at any moment until my mom reaches out to pat your husky, unfamiliar shoulder, like you're a visiting uncle from Indiana or something. I warn her not to do it, but she does it anyway. Even in dreams, she refuses to listen to me. She doesn't say, but I know she's thinking, your shoulder hair is coarser than it appears, less like fur, more like small brown wires, probably useful for quick drying. How do you stand on the edge of a waterfall without falling in? Never mind. I say stupid, boring things when I'm trying to get someone to like me. My mom is too close, but because you're so beautiful, maybe she thinks it doesn't matter. Maybe she thinks your beauty is a barrier, that you will always be this cool. But the moment she touches you with that finger, you attack, swiping at her chest, her neck, her face with your black claws, each one of them a poised dagger. You're up on all fours on the sofa, cowering over her small body, a furry brown building ready for the kill. Your roar deafening, your meaning precise. My mom's last words are a gurgle. Nice touch. Anyway, I thought you were in the bushes a few weeks ago, but it was just a giant bull moose eating leaves. His rack was exactly the size of a kitchen table and soaked in fuzzy velvet. He reminded me of Elton John. I stood there on a trail watching Elton John grunt and eat leaves with my family and some other families. It felt like we were watching TV, but it was real life, you know, really happening. I took a lot of pictures, though I was disappointed that he wasn't you. Like the time I was trying to meet Sting after a concert by hanging out around back behind the dumpsters, and all I met was his sister-in-law. I was 19 and living in London, wearing a long velvet skirt that Elton John would have gone nuts over. My plan was to start singing the moment Sting emerged from the backstage door and he would be overcome and invite me on tour. When instead I was shooed away from the dumpsters by the security guard, I went crying back to my Swiss cottage flat. And on the way, I let a middle-aged guy with a greasy ponytail usher me into his closed cafe. He could have killed me, but instead he made me a steak while I sat at the empty bar nursing my shattered dreams and feeling very sorry for myself that I wasn't on tour in the arms of my beloved.
Ah, that's Jessica Lynn Peterson reading from Sound Alike Trap Thunder, her collection of essays. Thank you, Jessica. That was great. There's a lot in there. Really reflective, I think, of your work. What I hope, we all hope, is a metaphor, the grizzly bear. And that wasn't a real scene. And then what, jumping right to what we perceive to be a real scene, which is you as a 19-year-old infatuated with Sting. Mm-hmm. You jump back and forth like that very nicely. I want to talk about essays a little bit, Jessica. So I feel like that it's a writing form that, you know, in large part, you'd think would have had its heyday years ago, right? When, you know, essayists seem to be more in vogue. I want to say mid-century and that sort of thing, and earlier in literature. And yet here you are making a name for yourself writing essays. How did you come to this form? Why essays, not poetry?
Well, I think that essays, the word essay, the genre of the essay now encompasses so much more than the traditional form of the essay, which, you know, is really about exploring a question and explaining your thoughts. But, you know, there's just so many more hybrid forms that have kind of emerged since those days of the sort of linear form of the essay.
Which is what I'm referring to.
A thesis statement, and then you have the supporting paragraphs, and then you have your conclusion. Right. Nothing wrong with that, but the kind of essay that I feel like is kind of exploding right now and is the kind of essay that I'm interested in is this sort of lyrical essay that kind of combines these poetic forms and a sort of musicality and language with the essayistic question, kind of this sort of imaginative form that bumps up against fact and fiction and is very playful. So It's a very exciting time to be a nonfiction writer because there's a lot more allowable than there used to be.
If I close my eyes and listen to your words or looked at beautiful weathers on the page, I would have guessed poetry. Mm-hmm. I would guess poetry. So tell me, and you hinted at this, are there just simply no rules for essays now? Because, boy. And
it seems that way to the naked eye that there are no rules. But especially for the essay that you just pointed to, Beautiful Weathers, that's a type of lyric essay called a collage essay, where you take bits and pieces of other people's published words and you put them together in a collage to say what you're trying to say. And so all the words in that essay don't belong to me, but what I say with those words does belong to me. It's not just a free for all, you know, it's still the lyric essay in this sort of lyrical form.
Right.
It still has to obey its own rules. It still has to obey its own rules or you lose your reader. And so we're really interested in form. You know, all the essays in my book are kind of different forms. There's a letter.
Yeah.
There's, you know, this collage. There's, you know, there's, I'm trying to think, oh, there's the bits and pieces of a voicemail that somebody leaves me. And I think it's about just sort of setting up this form and kind of leading the reader along with these little crumbs, and you know, you can't stray too far away from the form or the reader gets lost and frustrated.
And I would just want to let the readers know, and this is, you know, praise for you, but it may be also reflective of the modern essay form. It's just fun to read, impossible to stop reading. You pull us in and pull us through. But lyrical essays, which I love the term, they're just a blast to read. And let me ask you, are you also a poet? Do you play with poetry? Do you write poetry?
I dabble. I know, I love that, actually. I dabble. The first play that I ever wrote was called String, and it was about a poet. And so there was a lot of poetry in the play.
Yeah.
But I never really pursued poetry, but I did take some poetry in graduate school just because, I mean, as an essayist, I just feel like I can learn so much from the form of poetry. So I feel like poetry really inspires my writing and informs it. And you can sort of get this of poetic sense, but I would never call myself a poet.
Well, I would call you a poet. And I think one, it's beautiful writing, but two, I take as my definition of poetry from Harold Bloom, which it has to have metaphor. And if there's metaphor in there, it's poetry. And this is just thick with beautiful metaphor. We are speaking with Jessica Lynn Peterson, and we are already rapidly approaching our halfway mark. Can you believe this, Jessica? This is the way it goes here on Rolling Radio. I know. It is Pledge Week or Weeks or something. We're asking our listeners to support the coolest radio station in town by almost any measure. And the only one with a program like this, KFAI.org. Go out there, show some love for KFAI and your friends at Right On Radio. We bring you wonderful writers like Jessica Lynn Peterson. Okay, Jessica, let's talk more about essays. And I ask this often of our poets who join us, who often write about, you know, very personal things. And they put themselves on the page. And they put other people on the page, and sometimes it's quite obvious who we're talking about. These are personal essays, you know, very intensely personal essays, most of them, many of them. How do you navigate the Scylla and Charybdis, I'm going to mispronounce this, of what you need to say and how you want to say it? Your life is not alone. You're not alone. You're with other people. How do you do that?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that you should never ask me how to do it because I don't feel like I've done it very gracefully.
Well, that's a...
That would be my first piece of advice. I have made so many mistakes. And this being my first published book, it happened very quickly. And I feel like the next time I go around, I will probably be a little more thoughtful and aware of, especially not when I, you know, more so when I'm writing about others. But I also feel like we respond to writing that is vulnerable and truthful. And it's really scary to write things that are, they feel secretive. And it's one thing to write it in a class and to show it to your classmates. Right. But once it came out, I wasn't really prepared for how I would feel for people to know these things about me.
Isn't that something?
It feels very terrifying.
Really?
Yeah.
But you should know, and you know this as a reader, and other people have told you this, it's really a gift to the reader. Because when we read you, we find ourselves in your stories too. So you should know that you're communing with your reader, and you know, you're laying bare yourself on the page, of course. But we go along for the ride too. But boy, you do.
Yeah.
So instead of talking about other people, let's talk about you. You do. Are you very honest about yourself and periods of your life and your body, changes in your body? To what degree, and maybe this is a guy thinking like a guy, but were you writing about being a woman? And if so, were you writing for women when you were writing passages about being a woman?
Yeah. It was pointed out to me that this collection is very woman-centric, and it's not something that I set out to do. But once you break down each essay, you realize, wow, like there's a grandma that's a hero. There's a female friend that's a hero. There's a lot of females in this collection. And I just think being a mother, I stayed at home with my kids while I ran my business on the side, and I'm a wife, and my husband and I've been married for almost 20 years. And, being a woman and sort of wrestling and grappling with those gender roles, and both in my place of business and at home and the domestic life, I've always kind of wrestled with that. I never saw myself as a stay-at-home mom, and I sort of fell into it, and I don't regret it. I loved it in so many ways, but I didn't have an easy time. And I think that some of the work in this book kind of reflects that wrestling. And I think that sometimes we don't give ourselves as women permission to say that's really hard and I don't really like this part of this. You know, I think it's okay to give ourselves permission to just admit that, sometimes it's just really hard. And that's what I was trying to do, I think, with some of these pieces, is just to say, I see you, I hear you. Mm-hmm. Being a woman can feel like a constant state of balancing act where you never put yourself first. And so it can be hard. And writing really helped me sort through some of those things and really see the beauty in all of that struggle. And so that, to me, that writing is a gift in that regard.
That was my follow-up question. If you go to writing to figure things out for yourself, to stop, think, you know, pause in the time, make sense of your world, and clearly you do. There's a section in here, page 61, you talk about wounds, and I have a piece of art from a local artist hanging in my home, and it's a monster with a tear rolling down its cheek, and it's a phrase in German which means look out for the wounded, and you talk a lot about wounds. So this is related to our past one. We're getting deep here, Jessica. So does writing help heal your wounds? Does it help heal your wounds, writing?
Oh, I think it does. I mean, I think that many therapists would give people advice, you know, when they start therapy, to start keeping a journal, even if you don't ever show it to anyone. It's just a way to organize our thoughts and to take emotion out of it and be a little more cerebral. And I really love to spin, to dig down and find the hope and the joy in things, even in the darkest of things. There's a lot of generational trauma in my family, especially with women, with addiction and things that have happened. And I didn't realize how much of that I was carrying from my grandmothers and my sisters and my mother. And if you crack it open, there's a lot of gaping wounds. And so that essay, Dear GB, I was really exploring this idea of rage and being wounded and what that means.
Another line that appealed to me, and I thought this would make a great title, anything in a strange place seems important. I love that. I could ask you to talk about that, or we can just let that go. I just wanted readers to hear that sentence because it really spoke to me. Well, let's talk about horses. Why is there a horse on your cover, and why do you write about horses? What's up with horses?
I did not pick the title of this book. My editors picked it. It was called, I wanted it to be called Living Room Horses when I submitted the manuscript. That's what it was called.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I liked it, but I like this a lot too. I didn't pick this. This was the first design that I saw, and I was like, "This, I love it. I just love it."
Yeah. It is a beautiful.
The sound like Trout Thunder is a phrase from the essay about horses, and it's really kind of touching on the feeling of being trapped in this sort of domesticity, and how do you find your way when you feel trapped in a life that you can't, sort of scrape out of the barn or something. So I write a lot about very large animals, whales, horses, grizzly bears. Yeah. And apparently I'm obsessed with things that are a lot bigger than me. Well, I don't really know what that's about, but if you were a therapist, you could probably psychoanalyze that.
I'm not, but I'm going to suggest fear and fascination. I'm going to, all those sorts of things that you write about. In that essay, you're riding a horse, very pregnant. And I got very nervous reading that. I have to tell you, and I know again, here's another guy thing to say, but holy cow, you were riding that horse hard.
That was stupid. That was pretty dumb. Ride him so fast. He saw, and that's another sort of, I guess you could see that as a metaphor, but he saw home and he wanted to get there. If you've ever gone on a horse ride, the horse is always steam when you turn toward home. And so
they lose their
mind. He was probably like, this is fine. I know I'm not going to hit this tree, you know?
Yeah, I know. But it really speaks.
I literally didn't wear a helmet because I wanted I didn't want to mess up my hair. Like, that's terrible.
I got a big laugh in the studio. Yeah, you probably heard that.
That's literally the reason. And I hope my son never hears it.
Oh my God, that's great. Well, you have to tell him that someday, maybe not yet. So where do your ideas come from? You sort of hinted at this. Do you sit down every morning? I ask poets a lot this similar question. Is there a time of day you write? Do you wait for something to hit you? Do you make yourself get X number of words done a day?
No, I don't. I'm the most undisciplined writer. When I was in graduate school, I poked my way through graduate school. It took me 4 years. Mm-hmm. And, that sort of discipline, really, that's where I wrote this book. But I become obsessed with things. If I see something in the news, or I'm on a walk and I see a certain bird, or read an article in National Geographic, I get an image in my head and it latches on, and I can't stop thinking about it. The grizzly bear essay, that was based on a walk that I did with my family in Montana and a dream that I had about a grizzly bear, and they sort of, but I did become quite obsessed with this grizzly bear character. And I would say obsession is an inspiration for me.
You make a lot of fun connections. And I want to stress to listeners, there's a lot of laughs in this book. Some really great smiles and laughs. You surprise us all the time with the way, I don't know, the way your mind works, however that happens, whatever goes on there. We are nearing our end here. I want to talk about what you're working on next. More essays. Will there be another collection? Are you turning your attention outward, away from JLP, or what's happening? What are you writing about?
Well, I've been in a transition. My family moved up. We left our theater and moved up north, and I got a new job and getting the kids settled in a new school. So
you're busy.
Once that all settles down, I can't stop writing essays. Okay. I have to keep on. I'm just in love with this form, and I'm going to be teaching at Hamline adjunct next semester.
Oh, you are. Good for you.
Get to teach.
Awesome. That's going to be online. So,
I'm going to keep writing essays. We'll see. We'll see what happens with them. Maybe I'll start writing about teeny tiny animals this time.
Oh, there you go. That would be cute little animals. I'm sure something terrifying will happen. Jessica, it's been a treat getting to know you and having you on our show right on radio. It's Jessica Lynn Peterson, author of Sound Like Trapped Thunder. She lived in Minneapolis. We've lost her to Duluth. It's Duluth's gain. We hope we can have you back sometime. Thank you for being with us.
I'd love to come back.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much for having me. This was lovely.
Absolutely. It's been a treat. And now this.
I'm here with Sivan Sipel to discuss his latest work, The State of Israel versus the Jews. He's a writer for Le Monde, the magazine America, the online news website Orient 21, and a former senior editor for Le Monde. He lived in Israel for 12 years and is now based in Paris. His book, Walled, Israeli Society at an Impasse, was published by Other Press in 2007. Sivan, thanks for joining me on Right on Radio.
Thank you.
So my first question, can you describe for us the paradoxical society of Israel? You describe in the book how it's not democratic, but very liberal. It has a thriving culture of secrecy, yet it enjoys an astonishing freedom of speech.
Yes, it is paradoxical. I agree. You know, in Israel, you can burn an Israeli flag in public if you're not Arab. But if you're a Jew, you can burn an Israeli flag in public. You can express any idea you want to express. If you're a Jew, the right to speak, to express an opinion, any opinion, is almost absolute. But of course, if you're not Palestinian, you even have the right to say that Israel has no right to exist, for example. It's an opinion. Then Israel had also adopted a law, the Nathan State, called the Nation State Law of the Jewish people, that rules that Jews and Arabs have not equal rights in Israel, even if both of them are citizens of the same country, have same passport. So it's very paradoxical. But I believe you, American, could, for example, it's easy to understand for an American. It's much more difficult for a French. If you look at the history of America, for example, during hundreds of years, you had a democracy for whites. I mean, for whites, and you had First Amendment. But this was only for whites. So it's something a little bit similar. Because if you're a Jew, you can say whatever you want. But the level of democracy is low. The level of liberality in speech or in opinion is very wide.
In the first chapter, you discuss the learned helplessness Palestinians have acquired. You call the Israeli occupation a dull headache for many around the globe. What are the factors that make the Palestinian oppression something we have grown accustomed to globally? In what ways can we change that?
I can tell you, there is a very good Palestinian joke. It goes like that. Two old Palestinians are chatting, speaking one with the other, and one says, we are so unlucky. We fall on the Jews. If we had got a conflict with the Jews, for dozens of years, we would have our state. So, but because these are the Jews, and then we can't have it because everybody support them. And the other one answers, you're wrong. We are lucky having a conflict with Jews. Because if we were Uyghurs from China or Kurds from Iraq or from Turkey, who would bother about us? And you know what? Both of them are right. Both of them are right. So, to answer quickly to your question, what I think is that people got used to the idea that there is no solution to the Palestinian issue. For many reasons, and I would say that the main reason is that people look at that conflict And the conclusion is one side is too strong for the other. So there is one side. Some think it's good. Others think it's unfortunate. But the Palestinians cannot win. And the problem is that they cannot lose, because the simple fact of existing is a problem for Israel. So there is no winner in that conflict. And then, and the whole power of Israel is not able to bring for a victory. They can just dominate the Palestinians. They cannot finish with the conflict. So it takes time. And in the last period, the difference is so huge between both protagonists that the general feeling is there is no solution. And altogether, it goes with another feeling. It's a kind of conviction that at the end of the day, if it doesn't disappear, if no one solves that issue, it will come back. No one knows how, when, but it will come back. And the reason is that Israel is like the last colonial state on earth. This is it. This is the problem. And it will not stand like that. It cannot work. All colonialism has finished someday, one day. So there are other kind of oppression in other countries, but this is pure colonialism. So it has to be brought to an end. So this is paradoxical. No one knows how to do that. And many people think that it has to happen.
I was shocked by a statistic in this book. American studies show that Jewish Israelis supported Trump more than anyone else in the world. Yeah. Why did Israelis see him as an appealing political leader?
You know what is an ideal type in sociology? It's the, at least we say in French, ideal type. Ideal type. It means it represents. Because Trump really represent a very huge way of thinking, very common in Israel. The first thing is that, first of all, the statistic is right. Even Mississippi, even Wyoming didn't vote for Trump, as the polls in Israel show that 70 to 75% of the Jewish, of the American Jews, of the Israeli Jews would vote for Trump. So first, Trump thinks that you can solve everything through force. This is, he doesn't know any other way to find a solution to any problem but using force. And he thinks that there is no issue that force cannot resolve. The second point is that he's very disruptive. He's not ashamed of using racist or xenophobic arguments. Thirdly, he shares with Israel an equal disdain for international law. He makes his own law, like Israel. And a wide majority of Israeli Jews think that this is the right way of thinking, because this is the way they think. They themselves are used since more than 50 years not to submit, for example, to international law. So the way he behaved, the way Trump, he behaved with a D, and the way he speaks was very attractive for the Israelis.
You mentioned a flourishing of what can be called a Jewish Ku Klux Klan in Israel. What enabled this group to flourish?
Well, this is a long story. Really,
we have time.
I'll try to make it short. The, you know, In 48, the Israelis expelled 85% of the 87% of the Palestinian population that was living on their territory. But in 67, they conquered the Palestinian territories, Gaza and the West Bank, and the colonization started almost immediately. All the governments, left or right, had supported the policy of settlements. When you look backward, it's impossible not to think that this was not planned. There was a will and a half-hidden agenda, I would say. So you take the land of a village for security reason, and then after 3, 5, or 10 years, you see a settlement built on it. This is an organized land grab. And it goes like that for 55 years already. So the colonial camp has grown like, you know what is a golem? It's a monster. And the colonial camp was not so big at the beginning in 67. It was an idea, but you know, the settlers were very few. Today, it's a huge force. It's more than half a century. And the colonial mentality was already present in Israel in 67, but it has completely invaded the minds of the Israeli Jews, if I can say that. And I will give you an example. I know a very good Israeli friend. I met her, it was just at the beginning of the Second Intifada. And we started to say, to have an argument, etc. And at one point she said to me, "Oh, you know what? You are a journalist, you know too better than me the history of my own country, etc., etc. I'm not able to argue with you." She said, "But you know what? I'll tell you what is my position. I am ready to make peace with the Palestinian and to give them back all the territories, including East Jerusalem. I'm ready to that. I have only one condition." Well, I said to her, "It starts very well. What is your condition?" And she answered, "They take us, all our Arabs." It means to expel all the Arabs who have Israeli passports. I can assure you, I know her well. She's a nice woman. She doesn't know that this is called racism. She doesn't know that you don't decide for the life of others. You cannot expel population that you don't like just before you dislike them. It's things do not go like that. It's not a way to solve a problem. She doesn't know. This is a mentality. She had the force, she has the power. So she thinks that it's possible to impose anything to the opponent, to the enemy. It's sad, but this is the situation.
I think it's a great time to segue now to my next question. Okay. Over the course of 50 years, fanaticism has played an ever larger role with young soldiers of the Judah's Eternity Unit, where you're seeing more and more religious ultranationalists. Yeah. What made this possible?
Now, again, the occupation. There is nothing else. I mean, when the colonial mentality invades all your way of thinking, when you think that the other is a barbarian, is evil by nature, that God gave you this land and that Arab ownership on it is illegitimate, even if he's here for 10 generations, and that taking his land for yourself is legitimate because God is on your side, you come to think that to eradicate the land from this barbarian population pleases God. And you start killing with the feeling that what you do is good for you, for your people, for God, et cetera, et cetera. And you start to behave yourself like a barbarian. And this is what is happening. Then, and then you act as a barbarian in almost total impunity, which is very problematic. I mean, what's happening in the West Bank is awful and terrible, or in Gaza, and there is no, you don't pay for that. You know, no one comes and asks you to stop that, or there is no boycott of this state, nothing. You can, they do whatever they want. So, you know, when a settler kills a Palestinian, it happens every day. You read Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, every day there is an article, not killing, but including killings and other mistreatments. And the Israeli police never investigate. And then comes the United States and they vetoed any decision of the UN, of the Security Council. So you get used to the idea that impunity is the best situation on earth. And it brings, and when you're a religious, it's a long story, but no, again, it's a very sad story because the Jewish religion was not, historically speaking, this kind of a very aggressive religion. But the link between hyper-nationalism and religious appeared to have terrible, terrible consequences.
There's an expression in Hebrew that goes to piss in the swimming pool from the diving board. What is meant by this?
Well, Hebrew can be very, sometimes, very crude.
Very crass, yeah.
And the meaning is simple. You and I, it happened once at least, we pissed in the swimming pool. Well, you know, it was hard. We decided to do that and nothing happened to us. No one knew. It's very different to go on the diving board and to piss in the water from the diving board. It's a way of saying, look, I do something which is forbidden. And so what? I piss on you. And nothing will happen to me. The phrase is the incarnation of what is impunity and the feeling of impunity. I didn't invent that. It's a phrase in Hebrew. And the president of B'Tselem, which is a human rights organization in Israel, is the man who said this is a situation in the occupied territory. It's pissing. The Israeli piss in the swimming pool from the diving board. I can tell you a story. There was a field, because that, there are consequences to that. There was a movie called Manchia by a filmmaker, a documentarist that I know her very well. She's a very good friend of mine. And at some point, it's about a neighborhood in the city of Jaffa, and it was destroyed to make it, it's near the sea, so it was destroyed in the 70s. To make a new neighborhood very for businessmen and et cetera, et cetera. So someone from the municipality says that the population that was living that, mostly poor Moroccan Jews, were expelled. Then the professor of the students that are here ask him, why don't you remind that before that expulsion, there was another expulsion 20 years earlier, the expulsion of the population, of the Palestinian population. And then the guy says, well, why to speak about that? Oh, says the professor, because this is history. Oh, says the guy of the municipality, I pick history. Pick history. Why do I care about history? And then he starts speaking and saying, the one who wins makes the law. And this is it. So we expel them. So what? Now, why I'm telling that story? Because for generations, young Israelis were taught at school, we never expelled a single Palestinian. They, how do you say, they fled alone?
Yes,
they fled by themselves. No, we never expelled them. Why did they lie? But why the denial of what they did? The denial comes because you know that if you agree to recognize that you organize an ethnic cleansing, then this is a crime and you committed a crime. So that's the reason why you say it didn't happen. We never did that. What say the guy of the municipality today? Of course we did that. And we need to do it again if it's necessary. So you assume the crime. This is a feeling of impunity. So what? It's okay. We know we expelled these people. And this is why Trump is so, has this sex appeal for the Israelis. He saved the things. And this is the new Israelis from that point of view, are quite different from the fathers and grandfathers. They don't mind. It's okay. You can say that we expelled. Yes, we did that.
You say that Americans have a lot of influence on Israeli academia. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yes. Well, no. You need to know that American impact on the academic fields is important everywhere, not only in Israel. But I would agree with you. It's more like that in Israel because of the special relation between the two countries. Half of the Israeli academics have, for a short or a long period, they studied and or taught in U.S. universities. And this strengthened strongly the relation between both countries and, of course, both academic fields. In many ways, the way of thinking in Israel and in the U.S. is often quite similar. So this has been built, but it's not only true in the academic field. If you take security services, for example, this is the same, you can say the same. The security forces in Israel and in the US, the CIA and the Mossad have a very close and special relationship. And you can multiply the fields.
So I think the best way to end this conversation really is going back to the quote that opens your book. The historian Tony Judt said that Israel is bad for the Jews. What did he mean by this? I mean, it's this issue of the Jewish homeland versus having a Jewish state of Israel.
Yeah. Zionism has been historically founded on two pillars. One was emancipation of the Jews through the building of a Jewish state in Palestine. The second pillar was a classic colonialism of settlement. It wasn't a socialism of domination of the native population. The idea was of a colonial settlement. This state of Israel was founded on two basic laws that stated that Israel is both, the nature of Israel, the political nature of Israel is both Jewish and democratic. It means both ethnic and democratic. But since then, this idea has shown that it doesn't work together. Ethnicism and democracy doesn't work well together. And you have to choose. It is either a Jewish state where non-Jews cannot have the same rights as Jews, which is the case now in Israel, or a democratic state where everybody has equal rights, and then the state has to abandon the ethnicity as its essential main component. Tony Judd wrote his statement 55 years ago, 55 years after the creation of Israel. But in 48, Israel proceeded to the expulsion of 85% of the Palestinians who lived on its territory. But in 67, the conquest of the Palestinian territory, the West Bank and Gaza, reintroduced the Palestinian issue inside the Israeli society itself. Today, there are 6.5 million of Jews, but also 6.5 million of Palestinians on the same territory. So Zionism has created a state, an apartheid state. Was it written? No, not necessarily, but it happened. What Jude said was simple. If the Israeli Jews continue to wish to live without Arabs, which means without the natives, they will continue to strengthen an apartheid state. And this has no future. Or it may have even, he spoke about that, it may have even a more dramatic future. Israel, in a foolish state of mind, could try to make the reality of the dream of so many Israelis to get rid of all the Palestinians. A new ethnic cleansing. I don't think it is possible today. But in specific, very particular conditions, it may happen. And if it does happen, Israel will definitely become a pariah state. In both cases, predicted Jude, Israel will then become a terrible threat for the Jews and for all the Jews, not only for the Israeli Jews. This is the meaning of the book.
You've been listening to my conversation with Sivan Sipel talking about his book, The United States of Israel versus the Jews. Sivan, thank you for being on Right on Radio with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And now this.